And so, before that house of Huang, the people did not as yet dare to do more than moan and curse, nor had they come to rob the earthen house which belonged to this family they hated. No, it stood up on its hillock out of the slowly receding waters, and Pear Blossom lived there safely enough through the bitter winter with her two. This was because Pear Blossom was well known by now for her pity, and they knew that she begged for stores out of the house of Huang, and many came to her doors in their little boats and tubs, and she fed them. Once Huang the merchant had gone to her and said, "In such dangerous times as these, you must come into the town and live in the great house." But Pear Blossom had replied in her tranquil, usual way, "No, I cannot, and I am not afraid, and there are those who depend on me." But as the winter grew deep and cold, she did grow afraid at times, because there were men made desperate by hunger and the bitter wind upon the icy waters where they lived in boats still, or clung to treetops as they could, and they were angry because Pear Blossom still fed the fool and the hunchback, and they muttered before her very face with her gifts in their hands, "Shall those two still be fed, when good strong men who have a whole child or two left must starve?" Indeed, such mutterings grew very loud and often, and Pear Blossom had just begun to wonder if she should not take these two into the town, lest they be killed sometime because of what they ate, and she too weak to defend them, when the poor fool, now more than 50 and 2 years of age, but still the same child she ever was, died in the sudden, swift way such have of dying. One day she ate and played as ever she did with her bit of cloth, and she wandered out of the gate and into the water, without knowing it was water, and not dry land, now where she usually sat. And Pear Blossom ran after, but the fool was already drenched and shivering with the icy water. From this she took a chill, in spite of every tenderness that Pear Blossom gave her, and in a few hours she was dead, since she died as easily as she lived, without a will in anything. Then Pear Blossom sent word into the town to Huang the landlord for the coffin, and since Huang the tiger was there, the three brothers came together, and Huang the tiger brought his son also. They stayed to see this poor thing put into her coffin, and she lay there for the first time in her life wise and grave, with a dignity that death alone had given to her. And Pear Blossom, truly grieving, was somewhat comforted to see how her child looked, and she said in the quiet, murmuring way she had, "Death has healed her and made her wise at last. She is like any of us now." But the brothers had no funeral for her, seeing what she had been, and Huang the tiger left his son in the earthen house while he went in the boat with his brothers and with Pear Blossom and the tenant's wife and a laboring man to the other high land where the graves of the family were. And there, in a lowly place, but still inside the earthen enclosure, they buried the fool. When all was finished, and they had returned to the earthen house and made ready to go back to the town again, Huang the tiger looked at Pear Blossom, and he spoke to her for the first time, and he said in his calm, cold way, "What will you do now, lady?" Then Pear Blossom lifted her face to him, brave for the first time in her life, knowing as she did that her hair was growing white, and her face no longer young and smooth, and she said, "I have long said that when this child of mine was gone, I would go into the nunnery near here, and the nuns are ready for me. I have lived close to them these many years, and I have already taken many vows, and the nuns know me, and I shall be happiest there." Then she turned to Huang the landlord and said, "You and your lady have already made the plan about this son of yours, and his temple is very near to mine, and I will still tend him, seeing how old I am now, and old enough to be his mother. And if he is ill or fevered, as he often is, I can go to him. Priests and nuns, they worship together at morning and evening, too, and I can see him twice a day, too, even if we may not speak." Then the three brothers looked at the hunchbacked lad who hung about Pear Blossom, lost now that the fool was gone, for whom he often cared with Pear Blossom. He was a man now, and he smiled painfully under their looks. Huang the tiger was somehow touched because his own son stood so tall and strong, and astonished at all this he had not known about before. And Huang the tiger said very kindly, when he saw the son smile on the hunchback's face, "I wish you well, poor lad, and if you had been able I would have taken you gladly as I took your cousin, and I would have done as well for you as I have done for him. But as it is, I will add something to your fee in the temple, and to yours too, lady, for money always buys a place, and I dare say it is the same in temples as elsewhere." But Pear Blossom replied softly and surely, "I will take nothing for myself, and need nothing, for the nuns know me, and I know them, and all I have is theirs too, when I go to cast my lot with them. But for the lad I will take something, for it will help him." This she said in mild reproach to Wang the landlord, for his sum he gave when he and the lad's mother decided upon this life for their son was too meager. But if he knew it for a reproach, he gave no sign, and he only sat down to wait for his brothers, being very heavy and finding it a grievance if he must stand up. But Wang the tiger still gazed at the hunchbacked lad, and said once more to him, "And would you still rather go to the temple than to any other place?" Then the youth took his eyes off from his tall cousin, at whom he stared very avidly, and he hung his head and looked down the short length of his crooked body, and he said slowly, "Yes, seeing I am as I must be." And he said after a moment, very heavily, "A priest's robe will hide my hump, perhaps." He turned his eyes once more to his cousin. Then suddenly it seemed he could not bear to look at him any more, and not even at his gilded sword, for he dropped his eyes and turned and limped quickly out of the room. On that night, when Wang the tiger was returned to the house of his brothers, and when he went in to see his son in his bed, he found the lad awake and eager, and he asked his father, "My father, was that house my grandfather's house too?" And Wang the tiger answered in surprise, "Yes, and I lived there as a lad and until he founded this house and brought us all here." Then the boy looked up out of his bed, and his head lay pillowed on his hands crossed under his head, and he looked eagerly at his father, and he said with ardor, "I like that house. I would like to live in a house set in fields like that earthen house, and very quiet, and trees there, and the oxen." But Wang the tiger answered with an impatience he could not understand, seeing that, after all, his son had said no great harmful things, "You do not know what you say. I know, for I was there as a lad. It is a very hateful, ignorant life, and I longed every hour to be away from it." But the lad said with some strange stubbornness, "I would like it. I know I would like it." These few words his son said very ardently, and so ardently that Wang the tiger felt some strange small anger in him, and he rose and went away. But his son lay and dreamed that night that the earthen house was his home, and that he lived there among the fields. As for Pear Blossom, she went to that nunnery, and the son of Wang the landlord went to his temple, and the old earthen house stood empty of the three who had lived there these many years. Of the family of Wang Lung, no one lived there on his land, and there were but the old tenant and his wife, and these two lived on alone. Sometimes the old woman took a withered cabbage she had hid in the earth, or a handful of meal she had saved, and she tied it up in a kerchief and went to the nunnery to give it to Pear Blossom, because in her years of service she had learned to love the gentle, silent woman. Yes, even in these hard times, the old woman took what little thing she had, and she would wait at the gate for Pear Blossom to come out, clothed as she was now in the gray nun's robe, and she would whisper to her, "I have a new laid egg from that one hen I still have, and it is for you." Then she thrust her hand into her bosom and brought out a small egg, and she covered it in her hand, and she held it to Pear Blossom's hand and tried to slip it in, and she coaxed her, whispering, "Eat it, mistress. I swear there would be many nuns who would do it, for all their vows, and I have seen many priests eating meat and drinking wine. Stand here, where none will see you, and eat it fresh. You are so pale." But Pear Blossom would not. No, she had made her true vows, and she shook her shaven head in its gray cap, and she pushed the old woman's hands gently away, and she said, "No, you must eat it, for you need it more than I. Even if I could eat it, for I am well fed enough for my needs. But even if I were not fed, I could not eat it because I have taken my vows." Yet the old woman would not be satisfied, and she forced it into Pear Blossom's bosom where her robes crossed at the throat, and then hastened into her tub and pushed it away from the door into the water, so that Pear Blossom could not reach her, and she went away smiling and content. But Pear Blossom gave the egg away in the next half hour to a poor, starving wretch who crawled out of the water at the temple gate. It was a mother and she held a starveling to the shriveled bit of skin that had once been a full, round breast, and pointing to it, she begged of Pear Blossom, who came at her feeble call, "Look at these breasts of mine. Once they were round and full, and this child as fat as a god." And she gazed down at the small, dying creature, whose lips were still pressed to the empty fountain. Then Pear Blossom took the egg out of her bosom and gave it to the woman, and rejoiced she had so good a thing to give. In such ways of peace did Pear Blossom live out her life from that time on, and Wong the Tiger never saw her more. Now Wong the Merchant was very able to help Wong the Tiger in that year of straits if he would, for the truth was he had great stores of grain, and if famine brought poverty to others, to him and to others like him it brought yet greater riches. For when he saw what the times were to be, he began to hoard vast bins of grains, and even though he sold some from time to time to the rich who were able to buy at the high prices he set upon it, yet he bought also of flour and of rice from other regions, and he sent his agents out even to the nearest foreign countries to buy such goods, and his granaries were heaped with food. He had more silver now than ever he had, for as his grain flowed out to this rich house and to that market, the silver flowed back to him for it. And in this year Wong the Merchant was burdened with his silver, and he was put to it to know what he could do with it and keep it safe. Being a merchant, he wanted no more land, and yet there was no other security men could offer in such a time if they borrowed money of him, except the land they had under the water. He took risks, therefore, at very high interest, and he put heavy mortgages upon the harvests of the future, and such mortgages that when the lands had drained themselves once more, it seemed that all the harvest of that whole region would pour into the granaries of Wong the Merchant. But not one knew fully how rich he was, for he kept even his own sons pressed for the silver they wanted to spend, and he made poor face before every one of his sons, and held them to their clerkships in his shops and markets, so there was not one among his sons, except his eldest whom he had given to Wong the Tiger, who did not look for the day when his father was gone, and he could leave the shop or the markets and spend something for the play and the good garments which Wong the Merchant would not let them have now. Nor were his sons the only ones who hated their servitude, for there were certain of the farmers in that countryside, and one of them, that shelf-toothed man who had bought largely of Wang Lung's land when he was dead, and now that the land was most of it under water, he pinched and starved and saw his children near to starvation before he would borrow from Wong the Merchant. And he waited for his land to come up out of the water, and while he waited, he took his brood and went south to some southern city, choosing such a life rather than to let Wong the Merchant get a hold upon his land. But Wong the Merchant was righteous enough in his own eyes, for he told himself and all who came to borrow of him that men must not expect to borrow money or buy grain in times of scarcity, at the prices not higher than usual, else what profit can there be to a man who is a merchant? He did no more, therefore, than what was just in his own eyes. Yet he was wise man enough, and he knew that men do not think of justice in such times, and he knew he was very heartily hated. And he knew that Wong the Tiger was of some service to him even in the very fact that he was lord of war. He exerted himself, therefore, and he promised certain very large stores of grain to Wong the Tiger, and he lent him a great sum at not very great interest, and not above 20% or so on a silver piece. When they sealed the bargain one day in the tea-house, Wong the landlord, who sat by, sighed heavily, and he said, "My little brother, I wish I were rich as this merchant brother of ours, but the truth is I grow poorer every year. I have no good business such as he has, and nothing but a little money loaned and a little land left out of all my father's fields. It is a good thing for us all that we have one rich man among us." At this Wong the Merchant could not forbear a very sour smile, and he said plainly, for he had no grace of tongue nor any wit of courtesy, "If I have a little, it is because I have worked, and I have held my sons to the shops, and they do not wear silk, and I have only one woman." But Wong the landlord would not have any such plain talk as this, although his temper had dwindled very much, too, in these later years, for he knew his brother reproached him because he had sold off a large portion of such land as he had left, so that his two sons could go out to the coast as they wished. And he sat and swelled a while in himself, and at last he said loudly, rousing himself, "Well, and a father must feed his sons, I believe, and I hold my sons a little too precious to make them spend their good young strength at a counter somewhere. If I honor my father's grandsons, shall I let them starve? It is my duty to feed my children, I believe. But perhaps I do not know my duty when I keep my sons as a lord's sons should be kept. He could not say more, for a hoarse, constant cough troubled him these years, and it came rumbling out of his bosom now, and racked him. Being speechless a while, he could only sit swelling and angry, and his eyes were sunken in his fat cheeks, and the red mounted slowly up his thick neck. But Wang the merchant let a little smile creep upon his own thin and withered cheeks, for he saw his brother understood himself reproved, and no more need be said. Now when the bargain was signed and sealed, then Wang the merchant would have it written down, and at this Wang the tiger shouted out,
"What? Are we not brothers?"
And Wang the merchant said, as though in apology,
"It is for my own memory. I have such a feeble memory nowadays."
But he held the brush to Wang the tiger so that he must perforce take it and put his name down. Then Wang the second said, still smiling,
"Is your seal about you too?"
Then Wang the tiger must take out the seal he carried in his girdle that had his name carven on the stone, and he must stamp that too upon the paper before Wang the merchant would take it and fold it and thrust it carefully into his own girdle bag. And watching him, Wang the tiger grew angry, even while he had what he wanted, and he swore to himself that he must enlarge his territory somehow, and he wished he had not let these years slip by as he had, so that once again he was dependent upon this brother. But for the time Wang the tiger's men were saved, and he called for his son to be made ready and for his guardsmen to gather themselves, and they would go home. It was now well upon spring, and the lands were drying rapidly, and everywhere men were eager for new seed to put into their lands. And everywhere men forgot the winter and all the dead, and they looked forward, hopeful again, to the spring. So also did Wang the tiger feel himself eager for new things, and he told his brothers farewell. Then the two brothers gave him a feast of departure, and after the feast Wang the tiger went into that place where the tablets of his ancestors were kept, and he lit incense there. He had his son by him as he lit it, and while the dense, sweet smoke curled upwards, Wang the tiger made his obeisances to his father and to his father's fathers, and he bade his son bow also. Watching the gallant figure of his son thus bowing, Wang the tiger felt a strong, sweet pride rise in him, and it seemed to him that the spirits of those dead gathered close to see so fine a one as this descended from their line, and he felt he had done what he should in his family. When all was finished and the incense burned to the ashes in the urn, Wang the tiger mounted his horse, and his son mounted his own horse, and with their guardsmen they rode back by dry land to their own regions. Chapter 28. In the spring of the year when Wang the tiger's son was 15 full years of age, the tutor whom Wang the tiger had hired for his son came to him one day as he walked in his court alone, and he said,
"My general, I have taught the young general, your son, all that I can alone, and he needs to go into a school of war where he will have comrades with whom to march and to fight and to practice war."
It seemed to Wang the tiger, although he knew this day must come, as though a dozen years had passed as the turn of a hand. He sent for his son to come to him there in the court, and he felt suddenly weary and old, and he sat down upon a stone seat that was under a juniper tree and waited for his son. When the lad came through the round gate between the courts, walking with his steady, somewhat slow step, Wang the tiger looked at him newly. It was true that the lad was tall and nearly as high as a man, and his face had already taken on rougher curves, and he kept his lips folded firmly and well together. It was a man's face, rather than a child's. And as Wang the tiger looked at this only son, he remembered with a sort of wonder that once he had been impatient for his son to be grown and a man, and once his babyhood had seemed endless. Now it seemed rather that he had leaped straight out of his babyhood into this new manhood. Then Wang the tiger sighed, and he thought to himself,
"I wish that school were not in the south. I wish he had not to go among those little southerners to learn."
And aloud he said to the tutor, who stood pulling at a few short hairs he grew on his upper lip,
"And are you sure he had better go to that school?"
The tutor moved his head to signify assent, and Wang the tiger stared on at his son painfully, and at last he asked the lad,
"And you yourself, my son, You wish to go?
Now it was very rarely that Wong the Tiger ever asked his son what he liked, because he knew so well what he wanted for his son. But he had a small, weak hope that if the boy refused to go, he could use it as an excuse. But the boy looked up quickly, for he had been looking at a patch of white lilies that grew there under a juniper tree, and he said,
If it were so that I could go to another school, I would like that very well.
But this answer did not please Wong the Tiger at all, and he drew down his brows and pulled at his beard, and said pettishly,
Now what school is there to which you could go except a school of war? And what use would stuff out of books be to you who are to be a lord of war?
The boy answered diffidently and in a low voice,
There be schools I have heard in these days where they learn how to till land, and such things as have to do with the land.
But Wong the Tiger was astounded at such foolishness, and he had never heard of such a school, and he roared suddenly,
Now here is foolishness, if it be true there are such schools. Well, and so every farmer must needs learn how to plow and sow and reap these days? Well, and I remember very well my father used to say a man needed not to learn to farm, for he had but to look at what his neighbor did.
Then he said very harshly and coldly,
But what has this to do with you or me? We are lords of war, and you shall go to a school of war or to no school at all. But stay here and take my army after me.
His son sighed then and shrank away a little as ever he did when Wong the Tiger roared, and he said quietly and with some strange patience,
I will go then to the school of war.
Yet there was something in this patience which still made Wong the Tiger angry, and he stared at his son and pulled at his own whiskers, and he wished his son would speak out, and yet he knew he would be angry if he heard what his son had in his heart, and he shouted,
Prepare yourself, for tomorrow you shall go.
The lad saluted him then as he had been taught to do, and turned upon his heel and went away without a word more. But in the night when he was alone in his room, Wong the Tiger fell to thinking of his son going so far from him, and a sort of terror came on him for what might befall his son in those parts where men were so tricky and deceitful. And he called out to his guard that his trusty hair-lipped man was to come in to him. When he was come, Wong the Tiger turned to look at the hideous faithful face, and he said, half pleading and not as master to man,
That son of mine, my only son, is to go to a school of war tomorrow. And even though his tutor goes, how do I know what that one's heart is who has spent so many years in foreign parts? His eyes are hid behind his spectacles and his lips behind his hairs, and he seems strange to me when I think my son must trust wholly to him. Now you shall go with my son, for I know you, and there is no one else whom I know as I do you, who have been with me when I was poor and alone, and you were then what you are now that I am rich and strong. My son is my best possession, and you are to watch over him for me.
Now here was a strange thing, for when Wong the Tiger said this, the hair-lipped man spoke up stoutly, and he was so earnest his words came whistling through his teeth.
My general, in this one thing I will not obey you, for I will stay by you. If the young general must go, I will pick 50 good, true men, not young, and I will teach them your duty to him, but I will stay where you are. You do not know how you need a true man near you, for in an army so great as yours there are always discontents and festerings, and this man angry and that man talking of some better general, and there are very ugly rumors now of some new strange war gathering out of the south.
To this Wong the Tiger answered stubbornly,
You hold yourself too dear. Have I not the pig butcher yet?
Then the hair-lipped man grew very scornful, and he twisted his face frightfully in his agitation, and he said,
That fool! Yes, he is well enough at picking flies out of the air, and if I tell him whom to strike and when to strike, he can deal a blow with his great fist. But he has not wit enough to see anything until he is told where to look.
He would not be moved at all, and Wong the Tiger commanded him, and bore with his rebelliousness as he would never have borne with such refusal in any other. And at last the hair-lipped man said over and over,
Well, and I can fall on my sword then. Well, I have my sword and my throat here together.
In the end, there was nothing to do but to give in to this man, and when he saw Wong the Tiger would do so, he grew very cheerful, although a moment before he had been doleful and talking of dying. He ran out that very night and chose his 50 men, and he rounded them out of their sleep, and he cursed them soundly as they stood dazed and yawning and shivering in the chill spring air on the court, and he shouted at them through his split lip, "If so much as a tooth aches in the young general's mouth, it will be your fault. Oh, you who ought to die! And your whole business is to go with him wherever he goes, and stand about and guard him. At night you are to lie about his bed, and in the day you are not to trust anyone or listen to anyone, no, not even to him. If he grows willful and says he will not have you, and that you encumber him, you are to answer, 'We are under the old general, your father, and he pays us, and we must hear him only.' Yes, you are to guard him against your own self." And he cursed the 50 men very richly and completely to frighten them well, and make them know how grave their duty was, and at last he said, "But if you do well, you shall receive a good reward, for there is no more generous heart than our old general's heart, and I will speak for you myself." Then they roared out their promise, for they knew this trusty man was nearer to their general than any except his own son, and the truth was they were pleased enough to go to foreign parts and see what they had not seen. Then when the morning came, Wang the Tiger rose from his sleepless bed, and he let his son go, and he went with him away because he could not bear to part with him. Yet it was but a small respite, and a little putting off what must come. And when he had ridden a while beside his son, he drew rein and said abruptly, "Son, it has been said from ancient times that though a man go with his friend 3,000 miles, yet must the parting come. And so it must be with you and me. Farewell." He sat very stiffly upon his horse then, and he received the obeisances of his son. And he sat and watched the lad leap into the saddle again and ride away with his 50 men and his tutor. Then Wang the Tiger turned his horse about, and he rode back to his empty house, and he looked no more after his son. 3 days did Wang the Tiger allow himself to grieve, and he could not set his hand to do anything, nor his heart to any planning, until the last of the men he had sent out with his son as messengers came back to make report. They came back every few hours from different places upon the road, and each brought his own report. One said, "He is very well, and rather more gay than his wont is. Twice he dismounted from his horse and stepped into a field where a farmer was and talked with him." "And what could he have to say to such an one?" asked Wang the Tiger, astonished. And the man replied, remembering faithfully, "He asked him what seed he planted, and he looked to see the seed, and he looked to see how the ox was tied to the plow, and his men laughed to see him, but he did not care, and stared sturdily at the ox and how it was tied." Then Wang the Tiger was puzzled, and he said, "I do not see why a lord of war should care to see how an ox is tied or what seed it is." And he waited, and then said impatiently, "Have you no more to say than this?" The man thought a while and answered, "At night he stopped at an inn, and he ate heartily of bread and meat and some soft rice and fish, but he drank but one small bowl of wine. There I left him, and came back to bring the news." Then another came, and another with such news of how his son did, and what he ate and drank, and so they reported until the day when the lad reached the place where he was to go by boat upon the river to the sea. Then Wang the Tiger could but wait for some letter to come, for further then his men could not follow. Now whether or not Wang the Tiger could have borne his restlessness without his son he did not know, but two matters came to divert and draw his heart out of himself. The first was that spies came back with strange news out of the south, and they said, "We hear a very curious war is coming up out of the south, and it is a war of some sort of overturning and revolution, and not a good and usual war between lords of war." Then Wang the Tiger answered somewhat scornfully, for he was very surly these days, "It is not new at all. When I was young, I heard of such a war of revolution, and I went to fight in it, thinking I did a noble deed. Yet it was but a war after all, and while the lords of war united for a time against the dynasty, when they were successful and overthrew the throne, they fell apart and for themselves again." Nevertheless, the spies returned all with the same tale, and they said, "Nay, it is some sort of a new war, and it is called a people's war, and a war for the common people." "And how can common people have a war?" answered Wang the Tiger loudly, raising his black brows at these silly spies of his. "Have they guns, and will they wage war with sticks and staves and forks and scythes?" And he glared so at his spies that they were discomfited, and coughed and looked at each other. And at last one said humbly, "But we only tell what we hear." Then Wang the Tiger forgave them with majesty, and he said,
"It is true, that is your duty, but you have heard nonsense."
And he dismissed them. Nevertheless, he did not wholly forget what they said, and he told himself he must watch the war and see what it truly was. But before he could take much thought, there arose another affair in his own regions which pressed upon him and drove out any other thought. The summer drew near, and since nothing is so changeful as the heaven above men, it was a beauteous summer, with mingled rains and sun, and the waters receded and left the earth open and fertile. And wherever men could find a little seed, they had but to thrust it into this warm, panting earth, steaming under the sunshine, and life leaped up out of that earth, and the harvest promised food and plenty for all. But while they waited for harvest, there were many men still hungry, and that year robbers again grew rife in Wang the Tiger's regions, and worse than he had ever known them to be. Yes, even in his regions where he maintained his great army fed and paid, there were men so desperate they dared to form into robber bands and to defy him. And when he sent his soldiers after them, they were not to be found. They were like a band of ghosts, for Wang the Tiger's spies would run back and tell him, "Yesterday the robbers were to the north, and they burnt the village of the Qing family." Or they would say, "3 days ago a band of robbers fell upon merchants and killed them all and took their goods of opium and silks." Then Wang the Tiger grew exceedingly angry to hear of such lawlessness, and he was angry most of all because he was defrauded thus of his own revenues from merchants, which he needed sorely to make him free from Wang the merchant, and he grew so angry that he longed to kill someone. Then he rose up in his courts and shouted that his captains were to partition out his soldiers over that whole region, and for every robber's head they brought in, he would give a reward of a piece of silver. Yet when his soldiers rushed out, enticed by the reward to seize the robbers, they found none. The truth was, many of these robbers were simple farming folk, and they only came out when they were not pursued. But if they saw the soldiers after them, they dug and hoed in the fields, and told sorry tales to the soldiers of how they had suffered at the hands of such and such a band, and they told of any band except their own, and their own they never mentioned. Or if they heard another mention it, they looked vacantly about and said they had never known such a band as that, nor ever heard such a name. But because of the reward Wang the Tiger had promised, and because many of his men were greedy, they killed any man they could and brought his head in and said it was a robber's head, and none could say it was not, and so they received the reward. There were thus many killed who were innocent, but no one dared to complain, for they knew that Wang the Tiger sent his men out in a good and lawful cause, and if they complained it might anger some soldier and draw attention to him who complained, and put it in the soldier's mind that this one who complained had a head also. But one day in the midsummer, when the sorghum cane was very high, and much higher than men standing, the robbers spread everywhere like a sudden blaze of fire, and Wang the Tiger was angry to such a pitch that he rose up one day himself against the robbers, although he had not gone out thus for many a day and year. But he heard of a certain small band in a village, and his spies had watched, and they had seen that by day the villagers were farmers, and by night they were robbers. It seemed the lands these villagers had were very low, and the village lay in a great hollow, and the farmers had not been able to plant even so soon as others, and so they were still not fed, such as had not starved in the winter and spring. Now when Wang the Tiger had this certain knowledge of how evil these men were, and how they went by night to other villages and robbed them of their food and killed those who resisted, his anger swelled up in him, and he went himself with his men to that village, and he commanded them to surround the village and leave no way open for any to escape. Then with other men he went galloping in, and they seized every man, 173 men in all, young and old. When they were caught and held and tied together by ropes, Wang the Tiger commanded them to be brought to a certain large threshing floor before the head villager's house. And there from his horse he glowered upon these wretched men. Some of them wept and trembled, and some were the color of clay, but some stood sullen and fearless, having already known despair. Only the old men were tranquil and accepted whatever must come, since now they were so old, and every one of them expected death. But Wang the Tiger, when he saw he had them all, felt his killing anger cool in him. He could not kill as lustily as once he did. No, He had been secretly weaker since he killed the six men and saw his son's look. And to hide his weakness now, he drew down his brows and pursed his lips, and he roared at them.
You deserve to die, every man of you. Have you not known me these many years that I will not have robbers in my lands? Yet I am a merciful man. I will remember your old parents and your little sons, and this time I will not kill you. No, I will save death for the next time you dare to disobey me and rob again.
Then he called to his own men who surrounded the villagers, and he said,
Draw out your sharp girdle knives and cut off their ears only, for a warning that they may remember what I have told them this day.
Then the soldiers of Wong the Tiger stepped forward, and they whetted their knives upon the soles of their shoes, and they cut off the ears of the robbers, and heaped the ears upon the ground before Wong the Tiger. And Wong the Tiger looked at the robbers, every man with two streams of his blood running down his cheeks, and he said,
Let these ears of yours be sign of remembrance.
Then he turned his horse and galloped away, and as he went his heart misgave him, that perhaps he ought to have killed the robbers, and finished them clean, and so cleansed his regions, for such a death would have warned others. And his heart misgave him that perhaps he grew weak and too merciful, now as he grew old. But he comforted himself by saying to himself,
It was for my son's sake I saved those lives, and some day I will tell him how, for his sake, I did not kill 173 men, and it will please him.
Chapter 29 In these ways did Wong the Tiger fill the months his son left him empty and alone in his house. When he had put down the robbers once more in his regions, and when the harvests came on and helped him because the people were fed again, he took a small half of his army, and in the autumn when it was neither cold with winds nor hot with sunshine, he went over all his lands once more, and he told himself he must see that all was ordered for his son when he returned. For now Wong the Tiger planned that when his son came back he would give over to him the generalship in these parts, and he would give to him his vast army, keeping only a little guard for himself. He would be 55 years old, and his son would be 20 years old, and a man. Dreaming such dreams, Wong the Tiger rode over his lands, and with his inward eye he saw here his son's son, and with his outward eye he marked the people and the land, and what revenues there were, and what promise of good harvest. Now that the famine had died away once more, the lands did well, although land and people still showed the shadows of those two famine years. The land because it was not fully grown yet to crops, and the people because there were many still hollow-cheeked, and there were too few of old and young. But life had begun once more, and it comforted Wong the Tiger to see many women great with child again, and he said to himself, pondering,
It may very well be that heaven sent the famine to show me my destiny again, for I have rested too much in these last years and been too content with what I had. It may be the famine has sent to stir me up, that I should be greater yet with such a son as I have to inherit all I do and gain.
For if Wong the Tiger was wiser than his old father had been in his time, and did not believe in a god of earth, yet he did believe in destiny and in heaven, and he would have said in all that befell him there was no chance at all, not in life nor in death, but that every life and every death was purposed, and meet and came from heaven thus. In this ninth month of the dying year he rode with his soldiers joyous behind him, and everywhere men greeted him somehow, because they knew him for a mighty man who had long ruled over them and justly too, and they put smiles on their faces, and if he stopped in a town, a feast was made for him by the elders of that town or village. Only the common farming folk were not courteous, and many a farmer, when he saw the soldiers coming, turned his back to the road and worked doggedly on in his field. And when they were past, he spat and spat again to free his heart of hatred. Yet if any soldier had asked him fiercely why he spat, he would have covered his face with vacant innocence and answered, Because of so much dust that blew into my mouth from under the horse's feet that passed. But Wong the Tiger did not need to care for any man, in town or countryside. Now in his journeying he came to that city he had once besieged, where his pocked nephew had lived these many years for him, and Wong the Tiger sent messengers ahead to announce his coming. and he looked keenly to right and to left to see how this town had done under his nephew's rule. This young man was no longer young. He was a man now, and with the silk weaver's daughter he had for wife he had begotten a son or two already. And when he heard his uncle came and was even at the city gates, he was in greatest consternation. The truth was, this fellow had lived many peaceful years here, and he had lived very peacefully, and almost he had forgotten he was a soldier. He was always merry and easy in his ways, eager after pleasure and some new thing, and he liked his life here, for he had authority so that men were courteous to him, and he had no great work to do except to receive revenues, and he grew fat. In these last years he had even taken off his soldier's garb and put on easier robes, and he looked like a prosperous merchant. Indeed, he was very good friends with merchants in the town, and when they paid their taxes into his hand for Wang the Tiger, he made his little profits too, as tradesmen do, and he used his uncle's name sometimes for a light tax on some new thing. But if the merchants knew it, they did not blame him, seeing it is but what any man of them would do himself. And they liked the pocked fellow, and they gave him gifts sometimes, knowing he might report what he pleased to his uncle, and let evil descend upon them. So Wang the Tiger's nephew lived this merry life, and his wife pleased him, for he was not over-lusty, and not often tempted outside his own bed, except on the few nights when some friend or other gave a feast more vast than usual, and for a special treat had hired pretty maids for part of the night. To such feasts this man was always invited, both for his position in the town and for his own sake, because he was a witty clown, and he had a tricky tongue that could make men roar with glee, especially if they were somewhat drunken. Now when he heard his uncle came, he hurried and bade his wife find his soldier's garb out of some box or other where she had thrust it, and he mustered out his soldiers, who had lived too easily too, and had been his servants more than soldiers, and as he pushed his fat legs into the garments, he wondered how he ever had borne to wear such stiff, hard garb. His belly had grown more full, too, than when he was a youth, and his clothing gaped there, so that he must needs tie a wide girdle about his middle to hide himself. But so garbed somehow, and his soldiers mustered somehow, too, they waited for Wang the Tiger to come in. Now Wang the Tiger saw in a very few days all that had taken place, and he saw the meaning of the vast feasts the merchants gave him, and the magistrate also. And he saw very well that his nephew sweated in his soldier's garb. And he smiled coldly to himself one day when the winds died and the sun shone very hot, and his nephew took off his coat, he was so hot. And there his clothing gaped beneath his ill-tied girdle. And Wang the Tiger thought to himself, "I am glad I have a son who is a lordly man, not like this one, my brother's son, who is but a tradesman after all." And he was negligent toward his nephew, and did not praise him much, and he said coldly, "Your soldiers you control for me have forgot how to handle their guns. Doubtless they need a war again. Why do you not lead them out next spring and make them used to war?" At this his nephew stammered and sweated, for the truth was that although he was no coward and he could have been a soldier if he had his life laid that way for him, he was not one to lead out men and make them fear him, and he loved this life best now. When Wang the Tiger saw his uneasiness, he laughed his silent laugh and clapped his hand to his sword suddenly, and he roared out, "Well, nephew, since you live so well and the town is so rich, doubtless we can raise our taxes. I am at mighty expense for my son in the south, and I think to enlarge myself for him while he is away, and sacrifice yourself a little therefore, and double my taxes for me." Now this nephew of his had made a secret bargain with the merchants that if his uncle sought to raise taxes he would cry poverty and hard times, and if he could persuade his uncle he was to have a goodly sum for his reward. So he began feebly to do now, but Wang the Tiger was not moved at all by any such moan, and he cried at last very roughly, "I see what has come about here, and there are more ways of working against me than the way the hawk had, but my remedy is the same." Then, with a very rueful face, for the good silver lost him, the nephew made report to the merchants, and they sent in their own plaint, and said, "Yours is not the only tax. We have the city tax and the state tax, and yours is already higher than any, and it scarcely profits us to do any business." But Wang the Tiger saw it was time to show his sword, and he said bluntly, after courteous words had been spoken, "Yes, but power is with me, and I will take what is not given when I ask for it courteously. In such ways did Wang the Tiger chasten his nephew and set him down in his place again, and in such ways did he make secure his hold over that city and over all his regions. When all was sure and settled, he went back to his house, and he waited for the winter to end. And he busied himself sending out his spies and in making his plans, and he dreamed of great conquests in the spring. And he dreamed that even now, in his age, perhaps he could yet seize the whole province for his son. Yes, all through that long winter Wang the Tiger held himself to that dream. It was the loneliest winter, so lonely that now and again almost he went into his women's courts, he was so beside himself. But there was nothing for him there, for his ignorant wife lived alone with her daughters, and Wang the Tiger had nothing to say to them. And so he only sat heavily on and alone and scarcely felt them his. Sometimes he wondered of his learned wife, but she had not come home these many years, but she lived near her daughter who was at some school. Once she sent a picture of herself and this young girl to Wang the Tiger, and Wang the Tiger had stared at it a while. The girl was pretty. She had a small, pert face, and she looked boldly out of the picture, her eyes black and bold under her short hair, and he could not feel her his. Well, he knew she would be one of those merry, talkative maids there were nowadays, and he was speechless before them. Then he looked at that learned wife of his. He had never known her at all. No, not even in those days when he went to her in the night. He looked at her longer than at her daughter, and out of the picture she looked back at him, and he felt again that unease he used to feel in her presence, as though she had something to say to him he would not hear, as though she made a demand on him, for that he had not to give. And he muttered to himself, putting the picture out of his sight, "A man has not time in his life for all these things. I have been very busy. I have had no time for women." And he hardened himself a little, and he thought it a virtue in him that not for many years had he gone even to his wives. He had never loved them. But the loneliest hours were the hours when he sat alone in the night by his brazier. In the day he could busy himself somehow, but here were the nights once more, and they hung on him dark and sad as once they had in the past. At such times he doubted himself, and he felt himself old, and he doubted whether even in the spring he could make any great new conquest. At such times he smiled painfully into the coals and gnawed his beard, and he thought to himself sadly, "It may be that no man ever does all he says he would." And after a while he thought again and said, "I suppose a man, when his son is born, plans enough for 3 generations in his own lifetime." But here was Wang the Tiger's old, hair-lipped, trusty man, and he watched over his old master. And when he saw Wang the Tiger brooding over the coals in the night, and without zest for his soldiers in the day, so that he let them idle and do as they would, then the old trusty man came in without much speech, and he brought with him a jug of hot, good wine, and a few salty meats to make thirst, and in many small ways he coaxed his master to ease. After a while Wang the Tiger did come out of himself, and he drank a little and then more, and he was cheered and could sleep. When he thus drank, he thought before he slept, "Well, and I have my son, and what I cannot do in my one life, he will do." In that winter, without knowing it, Wang the Tiger came to drink more wine than ever he had, and it was a great comfort to the old, trusty man who loved him. If Wang the Tiger sometimes pushed the jug away, the old man coaxed him earnestly, "Drink, my general, for every man must have some little comfort when he grows old, and some little joy, and you are too hard with yourself." To please him, then, and to show he valued him, Wang the Tiger would drink. Therefore he could sleep, even in this lonely winter, because he was eased like this, and when he had drunk he put his faith very ardently in his son, and it slipped from his mind that there had been a difference between them. In these days it never came into Wang the Tiger's mind that his son's dreams might not be his own, and he lived for the spring. But there came a night before the spring, and Wang the Tiger sat in his room, warm and half-sleeping, and his wine cooled on a little table at his hand, and he had unfastened his sword and laid it beside the jug of wine. Suddenly, out of the deep quiet of the winter's night, he heard in the court a commotion of horses and soldiers' feet rushing in and stopping there. He rose up, half-standing, his hands upon the arms of his chair, not knowing whose soldiers these could be, and wondering if he dreamed. But before he could move further, one ran in and cried gladly, "The little general, your son, is here!" Now Wang the Tiger had drunk very deeply that night because of the cold, and he could hardly come all at once to himself, and he drew his hand across his mouth and muttered, "I thought in my dreams it was some enemy." He struggled out of his sleep then, and stood up, and went out to the court by the great gate. It was light with the flaring of torches held by many hands, and in the midst of this brightness he saw his son. The young man had come down from his horse, and he stood there waiting. And when he saw his father he bowed, but as he bowed he threw him a strange, half-hostile look. Wang the Tiger shivered in the cold, and he drew his coat closer, and he faltered a little and asked his son, amazed, "Where is your tutor? Why are you here, my son?" To this the young man replied, scarcely moving his lips, "We are estranged. I have left him." Then Wang the Tiger came out of his daze somewhat, and he saw there was some trouble here not to be told before all these common soldiers who came pressing about, and who were ever ready to hear a quarrel. And he turned and called his son to follow him. Then they went into Wang the Tiger's own room, and Wang the Tiger commanded everyone to go out, and he was alone with his son. But he did not sit down. No, he stood, and his son stood, and Wang the Tiger looked at his son from head to foot, as though he had never seen this young man who was his son. At last he said slowly, "What strange garb is that you wear?" To this the son lifted his head, and he answered in his quiet, dogged way, "It is the garb of the new army, of the revolution." And he passed his tongue over his lips and stood waiting before his father. In that instant Wang the Tiger understood what his son had done and who he now was, and he understood that this was the garb of the southern army in that new war he had heard rumored, and he shouted, "It is the army of my enemy!" He sat down suddenly then, for his breath caught in his throat and choked him. He sat there and felt his old murderous anger rise up in him, as it had not since he killed the 6 men. He seized his narrow, keen sword from where it lay, and he shouted in his old, roaring way, "You are my enemy. I ought to kill you, my son." He began to pant heavily, because this time his anger was strange, and it came up in him so swiftly and strangely that it made him suddenly sick, and he swallowed again and again without knowing he did. But the young man did not shrink now as he had been used to do when he was a child. No, he stood there quiet and dogged, and he lifted his 2 hands and opened his coat and bared his smooth breast before his father. When he spoke, it was with a deep bitterness, and he said, "I knew you would want to kill me. It is your old and only remedy." He fixed his eyes on his father's face, and he said without passion, "Kill me, then." And he stood ready and he waited, his face clear and hard in the candlelight. But Wang the Tiger could not kill his son. No, even though he knew it was his right, and even though he knew any man may kill a son disloyal to him, and it will be counted to him for justice, yet he could not do it. He felt his anger checked at the flood, and then it began to stream out of him. He flung his sword upon the tiled floor, and he put his hand over his mouth to hide his lips, and he muttered, "I am too weak. I am always too weak. After all, I am too weak for a lord of war." Then the young man, who saw his father sitting with his mouth thus covered under his hand, and the sword flung down, covered his breast, and he spoke in a quiet and reasonable way, as though he reasoned with an old man. "Father, I think you do not understand. None of you men who are old understand. You do not see our nation whole and how weak and despised." But Wang the Tiger laughed. He forced that silent laugh of his out, and he made it loud, and he said loudly, except he did not take his hand away, "Do you think there never was such a talk before? When I was young, you young men, you think you are the only ones." And Wang the Tiger forced out that strange, unused laugh of his, that his son had never heard aloud in all his life. It goaded him as a strange weapon might, and it woke an anger in him his father had never seen, and he shouted suddenly,
We are not the same. Do you know what we call you? You are a rebel, a robber chief. If my comrades knew you, they would call you traitor. But they do not even know your name, a petty lord of war in a little county town.
So Wong the Tiger's son spoke, who had been patient all his life. Then he looked at his father, and in that same moment he was ashamed. He fell silent, and the dark red came up his neck, and he looked down and began to unbuckle his leathern belt slowly and let it fall to the ground, and its bullets clattered there, and he said no more. But Wong the Tiger answered nothing. He sat motionless in his chair, his mouth behind his hand. These words of his son's entered his understanding, and some power began to ebb out of him and forever. He heard his son's words echo in his heart. Yes, he was only a petty lord of war in a small county town. Then he muttered behind his hand, feebly and as though from some old habit, "But I have never been a robber chief." His son was truly ashamed now, and he replied quickly, "No, no, no." And then, as though to cover his shame, he said, "My father, I ought to tell you, I must hide away when my army comes north to victory. My tutor trained me well these many years, and he counted on me. He was my captain. He will not easily forgive me that I chose you, my father." The young man's voice dropped, and he glanced quickly at his father, and there was a secret tenderness in his look. But Wong the Tiger made no answer. He sat as though he had not heard. The young man went on speaking, and he glanced every now and again at his father as though beseeching him for something. "There is that old earthen house where I might hide. I could go there. If they went to seek me and found me, they might look and see in a common farmer, no son of a lord of war." The young man made a little smile at this, as though he hoped to coax his father to something through the feeble jest. But Wong the Tiger made no answer. He did not understand the meaning of his son's words when he said, "I choose you, my father." No, Wong the Tiger sat still, and over him rolled the bitterness of his whole life. He came out of his dreams in that moment as a man comes suddenly out of mists in which he has walked for a long time. And he looked at his son and saw there a man he did not know. Yes, Wong the Tiger had dreamed his son and shaped him faithfully to his dream. And here the son stood, and Wong the Tiger did not know him. A common farmer! Wong the Tiger looked and saw his son, and as he looked he felt an old, known helplessness come creeping over him again. It was the same sick helplessness he had been used to feel in the days of his youth, when the earthen house was his jail. Once more his father, that old man in the land, reached out and laid his earthy hand upon his son. And Wong the Tiger looked sideways at that own son of his, and he muttered behind his hand, as to himself, "No son of a lord of war." Suddenly it seemed to Wong the Tiger that even his hand could no longer stay the trembling of his lips. He must weep. And so he must have done, except at that instant the door opened, and his trusty old hare-lipped man came in, bearing a jug of wine, and the wine was freshly heated, smoking and fragrant. This old, trusty man looked at his master as ever he did when he came into his room, and now he saw that which made him run forward as fast as he was able, and he poured the hot wine into the bowl that stood empty upon the table. Then at last Wong the Tiger took his hand away from his lips, and he reached eagerly for the wine and put it to his lips, and he drank deeply. It was good, hot, and very good. He held the bowl out again and whispered, "More." After all, he would not weep.
We hope you've enjoyed Sons, an Oasis Audio production, under arrangement with Harold Ober Associates. This program was produced by Tim Lundeen, text copyright 1932 by Pearl S. Buck. Production copyright 2010 by Oasis Audio, under arrangement with Harold Ober Associates. Oasis Audio titles are available wherever audiobooks are sold and on our website, oasisaudio.com.